today at 1 on Hometown Heroes. He was a history teacher here in the Valley for decades, but little did his students know the history he experienced firsthand in amphibious tanks assaulting Pacific beaches in World War II.
Once we got in range, we were firing, whether we saw anything or not. You were to pour fire in there, whatever you could see.
Don't miss the rest of his story on Hometown Heroes today at 1 on News Talk 580 or 5 p.m. on FM 105.9, brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our hometown heroes.
As Americans, we enjoy many freedoms. Among them are the freedom to vote, to worship, and to speak our mind. These freedoms have long been protected by the men and women of our armed forces and their families that supported them. For more than 15 years, Humana has made a commitment to our veteran community. That commitment continues today with the introduction of the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans and their families. In developing this product, we listened to more than 10,000 veterans. With their input and our 50 years of expertise in the healthcare industry, we developed an affordable dental plan that also includes discounts on vision, hearing, retail prescription drugs, and more. We are proud to offer this plan to our veterans and their families right here in Fresno and throughout the country. We are also proud to announce that Humana is now the 2012 exclusive healthcare partner for the MVETS. Find out more about the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans. Call our Fresno office, 559-221-2522, 559-221-2522.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom.
Hometown Heroes is brought to you by Humana. Humana is proud to honor our hometown heroes.
Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday here on KMJ, whether you listen to us on the AM side at 1 o'clock on News Talk 580, maybe at 5 p.m. on FM 105.9, or maybe you're one of those who join us from around the world online at kmjnow.com. I think you figured out that this program is about honoring our veterans for their service, for the sacrifices they made on our behalf, preserving those stories for posterity so the rest of us don't forget about it, and along the way, being educated and inspired by members of our greatest generation. We have one of those with us today, Elja Lee of Hanford, California, the seat of Kings County. He's only been here for 56 years now, but we're going to go back long before that. You grew up in Oklahoma. What was that like before World War II out in southwestern Oklahoma?
Oh, well, of course, I was a farmer, my folks were. We were not in the Dust Bowl proper, but we were in the middle of the Great Depression, and I remember it pretty well.
You spent your time, I'm sure, a lot of it on the farm, but I bet you played a few sports in school there, too.
Yes, basketball, baseball. It's too small a school to have football. We try, when the basketball season's over, it's still pretty cold for baseball. So one kid had a football. We knew nothing about football. Ruled we didn't even know what a first and 10 was. So we just line up, even half and half, and snap the ball and go at it. Tackle football with no protection. That didn't last but about 10 days. Then they weren't enough able to play to keep doing it.
Y'all beat each other up too bad. Well, I can't imagine there's a high school kid in the state of Oklahoma these days who doesn't know about football, huh?
I doubt that very much, yes.
Do you want to go on the record as to whether you're a Oklahoma Sooners or an Oklahoma State Cowboys fan?
Oh, that's no problem. I'm a graduate of Oklahoma State University.
Cowboys all the way. Fair enough. Well, you would have been in high school. I guess you would have been about 16 years old when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Do you remember how you found out about that?
We didn't have a radio. I didn't know about it until I got to school on Monday morning. That's where I learned.
And did they gather you all in the gym or something and tell you about it, or what happened?
You know, I don't recall that they did that. I think the ones that already knew about it just told everybody on the buses. You know, most of us rode buses.
And what was the name of your hometown?
Eakley, E-A-K-L-Y, Eakley.
Eakley, Oklahoma. So when you heard that news, did it register for you? Did it mean something to you that America had been attacked?
Oh, yes, yes. I was a sophomore in high school. So, yes, I was well aware.
So were you one of those who wanted to go sign up the next week, but you were too young?
Well, I do. Next week was out of order, but I figured I'd be going, you know, before it was finished.
And I've seen some of your memorabilia here. I see the big red flag right by the door of your beautiful home here in Hanford. How was it that you decided you wanted to be one of what they call now the few, the proud, the Marines?
Well, the main thing was I didn't want to be drafted. The second was I didn't want to be in the wintertime service, you know, where it got cold. The Marines were in the South Pacific and Central Pacific, and it wasn't going to be cold there.
So you were more concerned about the weather than the opposition? Because I'm sure you had to know as a Marine you might be making some landings and coming face-to-face with these Japanese troops.
Oh, yes. We were well aware of that. My buddy and I, we tried for the Navy Air Corps. We went to Dallas, Texas, which was a big trip for us. I lasted about 10 minutes from the start of the physical. I passed the colorblind test. Next place was the dentist chair. Dentist looked my mouth. He said, "Sorry, son, this is not for you." But he was a nice guy, and he explained to me why not. I had a little bit too much overbite, which shortens the canal in the inner ear that has to do with blacking out. And he said even the healthiest pilots may temporarily black out sometimes. He said your blackout would be permanent. So I was out the door.
Sounds like he kind of did you a favor then.
Yeah, well, certainly. No way, you know, I would do that. So that left for me if I wasn't going to be drafted. Well, I wasn't thinking about volunteering for the Army. No, I was already thinking about the Marine Corps.
And, you know, people that served in the Marine Corps seem to have a special bond with each other across generations. Those Semper Fi guys seem to get along. What was it like early on, though, when you first got into the Marine Corps? Was it quite an adjustment, the way they tried to toughen you up?
Well, not physically, it wasn't for me. I was a farm kid and all worked 10-hour days and stuff like that. The physical part was no problem. Staying alert, staying out of trouble from the drill instructors, that was all.
And I imagine these drill instructors were from that old breed of Marines who had served in World War One, maybe, were a few years older than you?
Our drill instructor, our main one, had five stripes. He was the only drill instructor I ever saw there with five stripes. So he had been in. He was an old China Marine. The whole works. Then we had Corporal Brown. He was one tough cookie. But we only had him about 4 days, and they took him away to his own platoon because they began to get short, I assume, you know. Our other DI was PFC Malik. And I'm not so sure that he didn't become a drill instructor before he may never have been out on the street yet, hardly. And as it turned out, our platoon was lucky in a way that the five-striper, he said, "I don't have these five-stripes for nothing. Says you guys tend to business. Don't screw up. There'll be a couple of three things that you will probably miss that you would kind of like to miss. Screw up, though, and, you know, you'll get it." And Private PFC Malik was lazy a bit. A drill instructor, if he's really going to put the guys through the box, he's got to work. And Malik just didn't want to work quite that hard, so he wasn't all that tough. And I saw other guys that are right around us, you know, that had probably a lot tougher time than we did as a whole. So I guess I was lucky in boot camp.
And, you know, I've interviewed a lot of Marines over the years. I don't think I've interviewed anyone who served in amphibious tanks before. And that would be your destiny. Is that something you volunteered for, or how did that come about?
No, I was the luckiest guy in the world in that sense. You know, they give you some choices. Toward the end of boot camp, I was pretty gung-ho, so I wanted to be a raider. And the sergeant looked at me, you know, I weighed probably 135 pounds. He said, "Do you think you could swim 100 yards with an 80-pound pack on your back?" And even though I was a good swimmer, I figured, you know, that's getting a little bit heavy. He said, I think you ought to look for something else, son. So the biggest break of my military career was I asked for the infantry. And, you know, there's guys trying to miss the infantry all around the place.
Yeah, I have to say you're one of the very few that has told me he actually asked for the infantry. Like you say, most guys are trying to get as far from that as possible.
Well, and they were right. The infantry, I can say this because we were very closely associated with the infantry. We led the infantry into the beaches and we were supporting them, you know, and that sort of thing. Nothing compares to the infantry as far as the toughness of what they do.
So you asked for the infantry, but you didn't get it.
Oh, you see that where the amphibious tanks, I was a tractor driver off the farm, and I suspect that's what put me there. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I just ended up in the armored and First Armored Amphibian Battalion. And it was the first of the battalions. That's why it's called the first.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and later on, you would get to see right next to you, as you're protected by these plates of steel, you would see those infantrymen, and I'm sure wonder if what happened to them would have happened to you if that path had worked for you. Let's talk about heading overseas. Were you excited to get overseas? Were you anxious? Were you afraid? What do you remember about that journey?
I don't remember too much about it in that sense. It was just like you're training to go. You know you're going. And all it's going to be is what day it's going to be. I guess by the time you go, you've got used to the idea that, well, here we go.
Do you remember anything that anybody said to you, whether it's a family member or someone else, that maybe encouraged you and helped you believe that you'd see him again someday, that you'd be back?
Well, through the letters, you know, yes. I had a high school girlfriend, and she stayed with me in letters until the war was over. I was fortunate there. Things didn't quite break right after the war, and we did not marry. I have a different wife. But she wrote every day. She went to be a student nurse. Well, you know, after so long a time and with nothing much able to say, she kind of say what she wanted to. I couldn't say very much. You know, that censorship was really strict. So, and then she kind of runs out of things right away. So what she would do is, in a sense, she kept a diary. She up in the morning and she was doing this or doing that, and she'd make little notes. And I suspect I knew more about nursing training than anybody that never went through it.
Certainly anyone else in the Marine Corps in the Pacific. Your first taste of combat came in the Marshall Islands?
Rauh and Namur. It was a very small island. Uh-huh. We never did get off the beach there. The island was so small. The 4th Marine Division, we were with the 4th Marine Division then. And of course, it's a green division. I mean, that's their first. Well, they hit the beach. When we got up to the beach, that is, they had some embankments and all that built up. We couldn't get over them. We're standing there in those tanks until some paths made somewhere. We can't get over them. Meantime, the infantry hits. You know, and I mean, they go across. They must have crossed it. Couldn't have been very long because it wasn't a very big island. In fact, the commander, I understand from reading, that he called them back here, and he was right, you know, because the troops began to pop up everywhere. But the whole thing for Rauh and Namur was over, you know, by the time the day ended, pretty much.
So from your perspective, a little uneventful?
Yes, in that sense. Now, we had a couple of casualties. One of my good friends got a bullet from somewhere. We're never quite sure where, and through his helmet, through his head. He was there on the beach. I remember having hold of something, because it was hot, very hot, until he could get transported away. And we didn't know anything about him. We just didn't know what happened later. When we started the reunions, we tried to contact any that we do about. Now, I myself had not talked to any of them for 33 years. A couple of Christmas cards at the end, and that's about it. But we kept looking, and finally located him. He had a plate in his head, and he was in the hospital for weeks, but he made it. But a sergeant that we would name the camp on Guadalcanal after him, he was up, still out a ways, and had the turret open, and he's up where he could see, and he got shot through the head. And that was about the extent of A Company. I was in A Company. There were other companies in the battalion of amphibs that hit some of the other islands, and they had more casualties.
Well, and I'm glad you were not one of them there or anywhere else. We're talking to 87-year-old Elijah Lee of Hanford, California. We're going to take our first commercial break. When we come back, we'll have him explain about these amphibious tanks, how exactly they worked, what his duties inside of them were, and what he experienced making those landings in the Pacific. This is Hometown Heroes on KMJ. After a down-to-the-wire Bulldog game, there's nothing quite like throwing yourself onto a comfortable bed. Paul Leffler here. You know, I heard my buddy Ray Ocanto talking about his mattress on the radio, and I thought, wait just a second. Wait till I tell you about the one my wife and I found at Sleep Retreat. Sleep Retreat is Fresno's only premium bedding store on El Paso, right next to Fashion Furniture. I heard Ray use the word comfort, but I can't imagine any bed being more comfortable than the Tempur-Pedic Cloud Luxe we're sleeping on. It's soft where you want it to be soft, firm where you want it to be firm, and if you really want the long and short of it, it doesn't matter if your legs are long or short. My wife Tanya's about 5'1 and petite. I'm 6'3 and not so petite. But that oh-so-comfortable Tempur-Pedic mattress fits us both like a glove. I guess I should have seen it coming. After all, Tempur-Pedic invented memory foam. Tempur-Pedic is the most recommended sleep surface in America. And nobody in Central California knows Tempur-Pedic better than the fine folks at Sleep Retreat. On El Paso, next to Fashion Furniture.
On the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with Elijah Lee of Hanford. Maybe he was your history teacher at Hanford High School, if you were a bullpup, or maybe your counselor at that school. He spent more than three decades there. He's been in Hanford for more than 50 years, but in World War II, he was with the Marine Corps in the Pacific. The Marines are an elite fraternity, but he was part of an even more elite group, the Amphibious Tank Veterans of World War II, serving with the 1st Armored Amphibian Battalion. We heard about his first taste of combat. And before I have you explain more about these tanks and how they worked, you mentioned seeing one of your friends hit and having that uncertainty of what was going to happen to him. You didn't find out till more than three decades later at a reunion. But what did that do to you and your own outlook to see a guy in a similar position to yours be wounded the way he was?
Well, I guess we're already into, or at least I was, into that mentality that if there's a bullet has your name on it, that's going to do it.
I've talked to guys on all ends of the spectrum. Some people say, I knew it was never going to happen to me. Some people say, well, I just prayed every night that it wouldn't happen to me. And other people said, I was sure I was going to get the next one. Where were you on that spectrum of your belief in whether or not you'd survive?
Oh, I think I would be more in the category that they hadn't made the bullet yet, probably. Although I like to think I'm a realist, and I could see that what should make me different from the guys I saw go down.
So that was your first taste of combat that you told us about. Tell me about these tanks, because I believe on those first two invasions, you had the same model of this amphibious tank. First of all, this is a brand new idea, right? I mean, it's not like this equipment had ever really been used in combat before World War II.
The amphibious tanks had not, and even the amphibious tractors, which hauled infantry in, they were built primarily to get over coral reefs.
I ask that because I'm curious whether you guys, whose lives are going to depend in many ways on this equipment, these big machines working properly, did you have your doubts about them since they were so new, and this whole idea of a heavy metal tank propelling itself through the water seemed a little Jules Verne-esque?
Well, I don't know. I'm sure maybe some of the older guys did, but I don't think us 18-year-olds even thought about it. If it's floating now, well, that's what we're looking for. Although we got a very rude awakening on maneuvers as to their vulnerability. We were maneuvering off San Clemente Island to come up a storm, and we were off ship, we were out there somewhere. got so rough that you couldn't get back aboard, because you see, you have to go up over this, that ship opens its mouth there, you know, and you go up there and drive in. My tank, we were out till midnight. We had long since run out of gas. We had a powerful water remover. I can't use the term right now. But only if the tank was running. So we tied on to one ship, but the captain pulled us a little ways. But he said, I can't do this. It won't work. Cut us loose. And we're out there in the middle of the night. We could have lost half the battalion, I think. Fortunately, they lost a few tanks, but I don't think they're really casualties. I know they weren't at A Company.
So how did you get to safety out of that situation?
We pulled up, floated up, or whatever, up to an LST, which is what we travel on. And the captain said, I think we can get you aboard now. So they passed out some gasoline so that you could start the tank. And the captain lowered a fifth of whiskey down too to kind of take a little of the shock out, I guess. And we were able to get on. So about midnight, we got on.
So you were familiar with some of the stakes long before you ever saw combat. It was a six-man crew on these tanks, and what did you do?
I was the starboard machine gunner, right side of the tank. We were two machine guns, and we had a little bit of protection. Not a whole lot.
You're not inside the tank. You're kind of on top with a little shield in front of you.
Waist up, we were exposed, except for the little metal things with, on the side. So we had some. We would have been a little bit protected against rifle fire, but not much against heavier stuff.
And it wasn't just rifle fire that came your way, I'm sure. And you made reference to this earlier when you were talking about the infantry, that your guys' role as amphibious tanks was really to lead the infantry onto the beach and provide them some kind of artillery support as they're coming ashore. So what, when you hit the beach at Guam, the next big battle that you were in, what did you find there? What do you remember about that experience?
Well, at Guam, A Company, which is my company, we were hit very hard by a 77-millimeter gun that was hidden and it escaped any kind of notice. The Navy had just absolutely torn that whole place to pieces. You just thought nothing could survive that. One reason is because of Saipan came first. Right. We were supposed to land on Guam 3 days later, but Saipan was tougher than they had thought it was going to be, and they didn't want to have two landing forces 100 miles apart. So until they secured Saipan, we didn't go. We were out on these ships going back and forth, and we didn't land on Guam till nearly a month later. Meantime, the Navy had that much more time just to pound that beach. And the what would today be Navy SEALs, but I've forgotten exactly what they called.
Frogmen back then, yeah.
They had gone in and removed underwater obstacles, of which there were a lot. But because they had that much time, they got them. And they thought they had everything because they were working right under the muzzle of this gun. It was set right down the edge of the reef, right where you come up on it. Mm-hmm. So all they had to do was just pull the trigger, really. Throw the shells in there. And because they had not made any kind of action, they didn't know it was there. If they didn't know it was there, they could have got it. So we were hit very hard in Guam, A Company. Now B Company, which was with us on the right side of the peninsula that sticks out from Guam, they didn't get hit as hard. They just had the other kind of stuff to contend with. And C and D Company, sort of the same on the other side. They had the mortars and they had the ordinary things that you might expect to run into. But they didn't have that one gun that was just pointing down at that reef, and all they had to do was pull the trigger. They had to close that beach for a little while. They were losing too many tractors with infantry going back and forth.
So that gun was just sitting and waiting, mowing down anything that tried to come ashore in that area?
Yes. As far as it could reach, you know. It wasn't until a little bit later they got some heavier stuff ashore that knocked it out.
So for you, you're on this amphibious tank with five other guys. They lower you off the LST. You're in the water heading for the beach. Are there bullets and shells flying everywhere, or what? Give us your perspective.
I forgot exactly how far out we were. We could be out a couple of miles, and we wouldn't get a short fire, you know. Then we would begin to pass Navy ships, not the big guys, but those LSIs, I think they were called. They were heavy guns. I mean, they had everywhere, and they were pounding. So we would be going and going as everything's going. But eventually, because there are no pictures of us coming ashore, because there's nobody there to take the pictures. Mm-hmm. There are a few that are off to the side and get us kind of going by, you know. Mm-hmm. But with all that carnage, I wasn't aware of it. Our tank crew was not aware of it. We're just concentrating on getting in there, and we're going. Well, they didn't hit us. Somebody else got hit first, and we probably went by. Because, see, there probably wouldn't be a 30-foot, wouldn't be a very wide band, because that gun is in a cave. Right. It's pointing out, and so it's relatively narrow. They're just picking things off that reef, which they were doing a good job of. So if you got through it, you're still facing machine gun fire, some mortar fire and stuff like that, but nothing really heavy.
And what were you finding things to fire at? Where were your eyes going?
Once we got in range, we were firing. Whether we saw anything or not, you were to pour fire in there, just whatever you could see. That's one of the things that I think I was fortunate to be. I fired hundreds of rounds from a machine gun, but I don't know for sure whether I ever killed anybody. You know, it could have been more than one. It could have been more, or it could have been none, or nothing in between. I like to think, well, I was just one of those fortunate. I'm pouring everything in there. I didn't hit anybody, but if we jump ahead a little bit, especially on Okinawa, because so often it was civilians that were a part of what was happening. The infantry knows they're there, and it's right there for them. Whereas if you're an artillery, you know, as we were later, we were trained in artillery for Okinawa. Well, you're throwing shells 5 miles, you know, or something. You don't know what's happening.
So for you, it sounds like you view that as a blessing. You're thankful that you never had to find out the extent of whatever damage your gun did.
Yes, that's the way I feel about it.
Well, as you're firing away, they're firing at you. So in that battle at Guam, and you use the word carnage, can you put into perspective for us what that looked like, and also how close any of those enemy shells came to you?
I can't put the carnage in perspective because of what I said a minute or so ago. We're going in. Our eyes are here. We were not hit, so we're gone. We land. We don't know all of this that's happened to our company that's out to the side of us. Now, I did see the tank on my right. I saw it hit because we weren't very far apart. Later, I learned that the machine gunner, who's in the same position that I am, is killed. Mm-hmm. He was an Indian lad from, I don't think it was Navajo, but he was in that region. He would cut our hair when we was aboard ship too long or something like that. I remember he did it with a pair of small scissors and a pocket comb. But once he started, you sat there until he was finished. He didn't know, loud old getting up and going in between. But we lost him. We lost him there.
Well, I guess that was the other question that occurred to me. And obviously it depends on what's shooting at you, whether it's small arms fire or one of those big guns like the 77 millimeter that was mowing people down. But because of where you were and how exposed you were, if your tank had taken a direct hit from artillery, any chance that you would survive that?
I was on the side next to the gun. You know, where he was coming from. none of our gunners on that side of the tank that hit, none survived. This included the captain. He had taken over the spot that one of my best buddies was in because he wanted to be able to see. He's directing the company. Well, that tank was hit, and he was gone. My good friend, Big John Wilson, if the captain had been there in his spot, he'd have been gone.
Well, and I'm sure you put yourself in that position, too, when you did. And you were a history teacher in high school, so I know you know a thing or two about studying history, and I know you've looked at the history of that battle and the casualties that occurred. When you see that big picture and you also think about the guys in your position who were killed, what does that do to you? Where does that leave you in your assessment of that bigger picture?
Well, I think it really didn't particularly change the assessment as I had from very early on. You're going and maybe you make it, maybe you don't. You referred a little earlier to the Marine Corps cohesiveness and stuff. You do feel, if you're in there in a fairly tough spot, that you will always have protection from the right and the left. These guys are not going to falter and, you know, leave you alone or something like that. I never really dwelt on it too much. Maybe being 18, trying to make 19. I did think in those terms, in a way, at Guam. We landed on the 21st, and my birthday is the 26th July, and I would be 19 if I could hang on for 6 days. And I was kind of hoping. For one thing, I knew from what we were trained to do and what we'd be doing, the first week would probably be roughest for us, and after that, we would be doing the kind of things that didn't involve as much, say, as infantry's doing and all that. Right. So I was just thinking, well, I'd like to be 19.
Well, he made it to 19, and that was 68 years ago. Now he's 87 and doesn't look anywhere near it. If you want to see for yourself, take a look at the photos on the Hometown Heroes section of KMJNow.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And stick around for the rest of Elja Lee's story when Hometown Heroes continues next on KMJ. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis, its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. I want to thank our guest's chiropractor, Dr. Wynn in Hanford. He's the one who recommended I catch up with Elja Lee. Elja and his wife Lillian met in junior college after the war. Their three sons and all the grandkids whose pictures dot the wall of Hanford's historic Lacey home where they live would have never been born if he didn't make it through World War II. When we left off, he was sharing how he wasn't sure he'd make his 19th birthday on Guam. But you did. Probably not a time to celebrate, though, huh?
We had just come off of a five-tank battle that was just about as rough as that one. Out of the five tanks, and we lost two of them. We had several casualties out of five. I don't think any of the tanks would have survived except the weather changed. Water got rough, so, 'cause see, we're out in the water. We're far from the water, and those tanks are just like bobbing corks, and the guns that did the damage to us are firing from a half mile away, and you think, maybe they could never even hit one, but they did. They had two. We would have got out of there. Our orders were the neck of that peninsula of Guam. It's very narrow. The infantry did not want to, if they sent too few guys into that at times, that wouldn't be enough. If they sent too many, until they knew where this artillery was, they didn't know, because it was back up, the peninsula bulged out, you see, so they could be firing straight in to that neck. What we were told was that they needed us to go in from the water and pour machine gun fire and so forth in to the side of the hill, you might say, because they said they might come out of there, you know, throw grenades and stuff like that, and you can pin them down. But if you get heavy fire, artillery fire, that's all they really wanted to know. They wanted to know where the artillery was. And five tanks is apt to draw it, which it did. There were dive bombers working that over, and within 3 minutes, they're up there. They know, you know, what's going on. And all they want to know is, where are they?
Well, that puts you in an interesting position. It kind of sounds like you were pretty expendable. You're a bit of a guinea pig, that they were sticking you out there to find out where the big guns were.
Oh, I think so. I wrote a paper on that. Before I wrote my master's thesis in history, I wrote an 80-page paper on that single action. Our commander, Colonel Warga, I wrote him hoping to get a little information, see, for my paper, because, as you're probably aware, they want first-hand stuff, you know, when you're writing a master's thesis or something like that. I wrote a letter, and I didn't know where it'd ever get to him or not. I didn't have his address. Mm-hmm. I wrote it to the Marine locator officers thing. But they sent it on, and he answered. Mm-hmm. He didn't sign his name, but he wrote quite a long letter. And he sent me all the battle reports for that day. Because, see, as soon as we get back, surviving tank commanders will have to make a report. Exactly what did your tank do? What happened? So I had that, and it still didn't change my mind any but what was happening. But Colonel Warger, he didn't agree, really, but he didn't push it, did he?
Well, I'm sure it wouldn't be a pleasant thought for him to think that he was sticking young men in a situation where they're most likely to get killed.
He probably wouldn't have known it at the time either, anyway. But there was an order that if he hadn't known about it, that if we got heavy fire, we retreated. That was the idea. And we would have, except one tank got hit. And they couldn't. But we could come back so far because they could only traverse so far. We knew where that line was right away. So we got there, and now these guys are still in there, that one tank. Well, we turn around and go in again. We do that 3 times until a Navy speedboat comes in and picks up the survivors of that tank. It's down, can't get out. 2 of our hits occurred while we were making those runs back and forth because they were Brackness. We were lucky. I'm up where I can see. Just as we were getting out far enough to get out of their range, they practiced on one side, practiced on the other. And with all that rough water, but I made it. In fact, the real fright I had was as I looked up, as we got out almost out of there, here came an LCI. That's a Navy gunship, you know, and they're powerful things. And it is going full speed. It also is going for that artillery. So they know about it, too. Even though they weren't all that large ship, they can't turn on a dime. They're coming. Our communication is out. I can't contact the driver of the tank. And even if I could, I'm not sure he could have moved the tank because they can't turn on a dime.
No.
And that LCI went by full speed. And when it's about halfway by, we kind of bumped up a little bit on the side of it.
Were you holding your breath a little bit?
I say, yeah. Of any single instance, that was about as scared as I was on that, because I knew what happened to hit that tank.
When the action at Guam was finally over, when your work was done and you were able to breathe a little bit again, did you feel a sense of relief, or was there a sense looking forward of, Boy, I survived this one, but how bad's the next one going
to
be?
I think the other guys, we're heading back to Guadalcanal. See, bear in mind, we came from Guadalcanal up there, and we're going back. By then, it was fairly well known, you know, that was one of the things that's so different from the boys today. If I had to make my choice, and I had a choice of being in, say, in Iraq as it was today, and going through that sort, I'd rather have the World War II myself, because once that battle's over, it was fierce and it would be bloody, but when it was over, you were going to have at least 2 months of retraining and stuff like that, sometimes longer. You would have no real concerns. I mean, there's nobody going to be shooting at you. Right. Whereas the guys today, they don't know every day. Every day they're there, they're going down those roads and things like that. I think it's a much more pressure situation for them. I really do.
Yeah, it's certainly not as black and white and easy to see where the enemy is. For you, your last battle would be the last big battle of World War II in the Pacific, Okinawa. That's a battle I've heard a lot about, and it seems like you probably would have anticipated a lot of opposition when you hit the beach there, but it wasn't there, was it?
It was not. That was a surprise to us, because the Japanese had always defended to the best of their ability the beaches. So expected the same thing. We rolled up on there. All we were getting was some scattered machine gun and mortar fire. It didn't amount to a whole lot. In fact, the lieutenant of the 3rd Platoon got hot water on that landing. The company commander was in our tank. I had become a radio operator after Guam. I was trained as radio operator to replace the radio operators we lost at Guam. I was on the battalion radio back in the body of the tank. My radio that I'd normally be on was the chief radio guy, because he's there with the captaincy. So I'm not seeing anything, but I'm hearing everything. Pretty soon, as the captain asked for the platoon leaders to report in where you are and what you're doing, on Guam, by the end of the third day, we had one officer left. A captain was killed going in. A leader of the 2nd platoon was wounded and evacuated a hospital ship. Later lost a leg, was in a naval hospital for a year. Company commander, now he was the second in command, he is on that tank that doesn't come out of there, that we go in to rescue. Right. And the 3rd platoon leader is also on that tank. Mm-hmm. And they're both wounded, so they're gone. That leaves Lieutenant Livingston, who was the leader of the 1st platoon. He's got it all by himself. Now, that was another plus, you know, in a sense, that an advantage that the Japanese apparently didn't have. Because all that happened was that platoon sergeant stepped up into the role that they had to fill, and the sergeant stepped up into the role of platoon, you know, they just, right. And they probably didn't use us as much as they might have otherwise, though, because we'd lost so many. The two officers that were wounded came back to the company a couple of months later. Oh, anyway, get back to my story. It's gotten hard. As they report in, the leader of the 3rd platoon, this is his first invasion. This is green. He can be more gung-ho or anything else, or wonder what's going on, than anybody, because he expects everything. Nothing. Well, he just keeps the platoon going. Now, the guys, that's what's awfully hard when you have to deal with a green officer. Even if he's a good one, the veterans, they know better.
You know better than to keep charging inland because it looks like no one's there.
They have a very rigid line. X time, you're supposed to be 200 yards in. Not only for other reasons, but they got planes. You might get knocked out by your own planes. They were a quarter mile in there. And boy, did he get reamed out. The captain commander said, "You so-and-so, so-and-so, if you don't get that platoon back here, that I'll strangle you with my bare hands." Rough. And he never did come to our reunions, I think, because of that, you know.
he didn't want to get strangled with his bare hands. So what happened from there? It sounds like you had an entertaining radio performance there, listening to all the other tanks check in. But how did that that battle unfold for you from that point?
The Marines turned north. See, this was a Marine Army deal. The Marines had two divisions ashore, the 6th and the 1st. The Marines turned northward. Or leftward, anyway, I don't know about the direction. Turned leftward because that was the more mountainous area. But that was where the troops were, the Japanese troops. There were several hundreds of them, but nothing like there was on the other end. So we were, of course, with that group. We're going along, and we're prepared for artillery if we're needed. They didn't know what to do with us as artillery. They'd never heard of an amphibious tank being in use as a, you know, regular artillery.
Because you guys had a 75-millimeter howitzer on the front of these tanks now.
So we didn't. We weren't seeing much action. We were trailing along as they went along. And the northern end was secured. We actually thought our Battle of Okinawa was over. We believed that the Army will never in this world call us down to rescue them on the south end, you know. They're going to do this themselves. And they tried awfully hard for quite a long while. But it was brutal down there. Eventually, we were ordered to turn back toward that end and go that way. And we passed an aid station or two. And we saw those piles of shoes out there. Because, see, we didn't know how it was going. We didn't really know. And but we saw that. We knew how tough it was down there. Then from there, we had two main duties. Artillery when they needed us, but we also guarded the beaches because see, wherever the front line ended at night, when that tide receded, you know, it was a quarter mile out there that they might try to come around over that coral. That'd be tough, but you know, they might. So we lined along there with the tanks. We could actually set down and on the water. When the tide came in, we'd just float, you know. That was part of our duty there. But they ran into a problem with one of the forward aid stations. A counterattack was about to overrun them. And, you know, it takes regular artillery a little while to move and get in a different place, whereas we could move like that, you know. So they called on us, and we were firing, I guess, I don't know how far, maybe 4 miles, 3 miles, with no forward observer. I was just having to go by the maps, you know, and stuff. We poured that artillery in there up to within 200 yards or so of that aid station and broke up that counterattack. Well, after that, we got a lot of business. Before then, we hadn't got a lot of artillery assignments, you know, and there was still a lot of time to go.
But you kind of proved yourselves in that action.
Yeah, that's true. I guess it's true because they began to use us as artillery. However, for the battalion as a whole of Okinawa, because there was no landing, no resistance on the landings, and as we were functioning primarily as artillery, our casualties were relatively light, even though we were there 90 days from the start to the finish.
And what was it like for you to realize that this was over, that there was an end, that, you know, there's a pretty good chance you are going to get to go home?
Well, not yet, it isn't. The war hadn't ended. You know, we'd been out there a year and a half or so. We fully realized that we were going to be there to land. Whenever are you going to end it? And there were a lot of them wanting to land in Japan. So we had to assume that our next landing would be on one of the Japanese islands. But we were back on Saipan. The war did end fairly soon after we got back to Saipan. Now that was a great day. Great day. But, you know, we had to wait. Even the youngest of us, unmarried, we'd been over there in enough action and long enough that we had the points. We could all qualify to go home.
Right.
Some of our replacements couldn't. They would have to stay behind and go on as Japanese as occupation troops. But those of us who left as a battalion left together. But we had to wait about 6 weeks to get a ship.
Knowing now what you know about what an invasion of Japan would have looked like and the estimates of over 1 million American casualties in that invasion force. Do you feel like those atomic bombs saved your life?
Oh, yes. Or at least I do, and I assume I'm sure the other guys did. Yes, because that would have been... Because it didn't need to happen, even without the atomic bomb. We had them strangled. Now, we didn't know all that, but we know it now. But the top brass, or at least General Marshall, some of them, didn't think politically the American people would stand for the war going on that long. Might take as much as a year and a half if you just sat out there and strangled them, you know. Yeah. So it looks like that the only thing that ended it was the atomic bomb.
When you finally did get home again, what did that feel like? What do you remember about setting foot on American soil again?
Oh, that was great. That was just absolutely euphoria. We got off the ship in San Diego. They trucked us up to Cap Pendleton. Of course, we were up there for us to prepare to go home. And that took a few days. Got to get uniforms, everything. Got our Liberty cards. Half of us are not 21. So they left birth date blank. We could go in at the Y down in San Diego and type in whatever birthday we wanted.
Sounds like you had some fun.
Yeah.
I know that you did go on to have a long career in education as a teacher and counselor. When you think about the generations of Americans today who weren't alive during World War II, who didn't live through what you lived through, channel that teacher in you. What would you want them to know and hold on to and understand about you and all the guys like you who achieved that Allied victory in World War II?
I would hope that they would try to read a bit and know a little about it to start with. There's been so many wars since, in a way, you know, that there's all these other veterans now that are doing the same thing. It's not on the same kind of scale, but for the ones that are in it, it is.
Sure.
And I hope they would understand that, too. The last thing in the world I would want was thinking that, okay, World War II, that was a great thing in a sense, and it was, and we defeated some powerful enemies. But for the guys who are still out there doing things, for them, it's just as important as what we were doing, the way I feel about it.
Well, I want to thank you for serving our country and for telling us some of those stories. Is there anything else that you think we ought to know?
Well, no.
One more thing for me. I know you mentioned other veterans from other eras and all the young men and women who are out there serving in our military today. You had a younger veteran who put in a lot of time and effort to have you honored here in Hanford in the last year. Some great displays of your memorabilia and some honors for you. What did that mean to you?
That meant a great deal to Pat Ford. I'm grateful to him. You know, Pat was a Vietnam veteran and wounded, I think, at least two or three times, maybe more. He was one of those guys that if he was still able to function, he was going to stay if they didn't send him home. I just really appreciate what he did.
Well, clearly he appreciated what you did nearly 70 years ago. So do we. That's Elijah Lee, 87 years old. Take a look at the photos at kmjnow.com or the whole gallery of them on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And join us again next Saturday for another edition of Hometown Heroes on KMJ.